You are listening to Punk News Podcast episode 558, and we were recording on a Wednesday because somebody had to go see King Crimson on Tuesday and Susie Moon on Thursday, so we're not recording on our usual day. Thanks a lot, whoever person that is. Punk News Podcast. It's Wednesday. Sam Barrett, are you happy to record on a Wednesday, or are you annoyed? And aren't you furious that some unthoughtful person has made a shift, our entire world around their schedule?
Well, I don't think it's unthoughtful. I think it should be normal, right? We're supposed to be getting back to normal.
Well, and actually, that is a question in that. Due to COVID, like, schedules were pretty, like, nothing's happening. So, yeah, Thursday night, let's do it. But now that things are starting to open back up and get popping again, that might throw somewhat of a wrench in the podcast. If listeners don't know, on the podcast, we used to record on Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, depending on people's schedules. But now we've always been recording on Thursday, which I like. But now that things are opening back up, maybe that's not quite as practical anymore. Hallie Bullitt, what's the future of the scheduling for the Punk News podcast? A very intriguing question that I'm sure the listeners care about deeply.
No, I don't have any thoughts on that. I'm happy to record on a Wednesday. It just means like the end of my week is going to be less busy, which I like for this week. That's going to be nice.
I do like recording the podcast near the end of the week on Thursday. You know, still got Friday, but I do like, you know, like we're getting near the weekend. We're wrapping up. Let's talk about the week's happening. And more, are you a creature of habit or a creature of chaos? What's your position?
Pure chaos.
So anyways, listen, we got some cool news to talk about this week, and we're also going to talk about some record collecting, actually, because we haven't done that in a long while, really. So listen, who wants to start talking about three cool records they've gotten recently?
Oh, I thought we were going to talk about this next week. Sorry. I'm like, I took a CBD thing for sleep. So you said what you intended to do, which is talk about this week, and I agreed. And what I was really agreeing to in my mind was talking about it next week. You all talk amongst yourselves. I'll just be over here.
All right,
my CBD world.
I'll kick it off. Listen, people. So I saw King Crimson on Tuesday, and it was the first big outdoor concert I've been to in years, frankly. And honestly, it was King Crimson and the Zappa band, which is basically a lot of veterans from Frank Zappa from his days as a touring musician. And it was big concert done right. We complained a lot about big concerts, but it was at the Mann Center in Philadelphia, which has phenomenal sound, which is not owned by Clear Channel or Ticketmaster, although they do handle the tickets, which is a pain. But $35 out on the lawn in a late summer eve. King Crimson played 2 hours. It was a lot of prog, but I withstood. And honestly, it was King Crimson sounded great. The sound quality was great. Free parking, $35 to see King Crimson and a Frank Zappa set. You can't argue with that. And what was pretty cool is I've never seen King Crimson before, and I'm a fan. I'm not a major fan, but I'm a fan. And this was an instance of the opening act convincing me to go. I'm like, King Crimson. I saw the Frank Zappa band was opening. I'm like, oh yeah, I'll go. So I went and I checked out. It was rad. But what was cool is King Crimson fans are heavy-duty collectors, music collectors, not necessarily record collectors, but music collectors. They love to collect physical music, and there are literally hundreds of King Crimson CDs. And at the thing, they were selling a whole bunch. So they had two box sets for $20 each, which was extremely reasonable. It's called like King Crimson Elements, which is basically like just the isolated drum track from a song or just the isolated bass track from a song, which I wasn't interested in. They had two live albums for $20, $25. I actually got one. But what I got, which I was most psyched about, was I got the, yet again, another re-release of In the Court of the Crimson King, King Crimson's very first record. There have been about four or five definitive versions so far. They've been like, you know, 2004, this is the definitive version. 2009, this is the definitive version. So this is like literally the fourth or fifth definitive version. Hallie Bullitt, M. Moore, Sam Barrett, and the new box set version of In the Court of the Crimson King, it is four CDs and one Blu-ray, which has about six CDs on it. It has 9 mixes of In the Court of the Crimson King. One probably would suffice, but listen, I'm happy to have all nine. As much as I'm resisting it, I am becoming somewhat of an audiophile, which I'm not thrilled about. And I got to say, it sounds really fantastic. Sam Barrett, what do you think the price was at the show for four discs?
Four discs, including a Blu-ray that I don't even know if you can even play anymore because no one has Blu-ray, right?
I just got one. I had a DVD player. I literally got a Blu-ray player like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, my God. Of course you did. Oh, my God. Let's say $100 because the venue probably took a cut.
And more, what's your guess?
$2.50.
Hallie Bullitt, what's your guess?
2 cents.
Wins. $35. Very reasonable. Very reasonable.
I was the closest without going over.
You would have won if this was like Wheel of Fortune. No, not exactly. Price is Right.
Price is Right. I would have been the winner. That was my strategy. I was doing the Price is Right strategy.
Yep.
What is also cool is apparently all the King Crimson records have reverted back to Robert Fripp. So essentially every King Crimson CD is now self-released, which is kind of cool. And so, yeah, man, I mean, if you don't know, I mean, King Crimson is a cool band. They definitely get too proggy sometimes, but when they're in the zone, they're in the zone. So if you want to check out a prog classic, the new 9-album version of In the Court of the Crimson King, and they're all essentially all the versions sound essentially the same. I would say, get it. It's very cool. Meanwhile, I was at the CD store, I guess, about 2 weeks ago, and I came across the deluxe CD reissue of Big Audio Dynamite's first album. This is Big Audio Dynamite. Of course, as I'm sure the listeners know, Big Audio Dynamite was Mick Jones' band that he formed after the Clash with Don Letts. And for years and years and years, I've struggled with Big Audio. People are like, Big Audio is so good. And I'm like, I just don't get it, man. I just don't get it. Like, it just sounds like random noises and clinking and stuff. So I finally got the $10, the hard-to-find double disc reissue of This Is Big Audio Dynamite, which has a remastered version of the album on the first disc, and the second disc is every single 7-inch and 12-inch version released to support the album. And let me tell you, people, I still don't get it. Big Audio Dynamite is rough. I mean, I don't know how anybody likes. I mean, I do love the song "Rush." If I Had My Time Again, and
come
I do
on,
like
that's
the,
amazing.
That song is. We'll get to that in a second, though. I also like their third album a lot, actually, which is considered the worst one, but I like a lot. It's called "Tighten Up '88." The first two Big Audio Dynamite albums, the second one, which was produced by Joe Strummer, considered classics. I just have no idea where any of these songs are going. It's just like, here's a beat, and here's some random sounds, and here's Mick Jones singing softly over the top with no real melody or hook. I'm just going to say stuff. And here's a sample of a cowboy movie from the 50s. Stick 'em up, Jim. You know, like that's every single Big Audio. Like, this song is 6 minutes long. I felt like it was about 15. If someone could explain to me what is there to get about the first two Big Audio Dynamite albums, I would love to hear it, man. I just don't get. I feel like there was no one to put Mick Jones in check. Like, the beats in the back are hip hop beats from the classic era before they were classic, which is actually kind of cool that he did that. But it's like, I wish someone said, all right, Mick, all you're gonna do, take the beats, sing over top the beats, and we'll put a little bit of music behind you. We don't need, like, all these buzzing and beeping and bipping and bapping. Like, it's rough. Do any of you like the first two Big Audio Dynamite albums? I've tried to get this into this band for 15 years, and it still seems boring to me.
No, I'm the same. I liked Rush so much that I really tried with the rest of their stuff, and I just, like, I couldn't get there, man.
Did you know that the version of Rush that you and I love isn't even the real version? The album version is so much worse than the version that you and I know.
But what was the deal with the version that became popular? That wasn't where did that come from? If that wasn't the album version,
that's the remix single album that I believe was featured in the movie called Singles or something like that.
Was it on the single soundtrack?
I don't think it was. At any rate, it's the remix version that is, like, the awesome version.
So good.
It's so good. It's like, Mick, why don't you just do that? And the crazy thing is, when Mick Jones was kicked out of the Clash, like, his last contributions were, like, the band's biggest hits. Should I Stay or Should I Go? Rock the Casbah. Like, amazing, super catchy, super poppy songs. Like, what happened? And also, I got to say, with Joe Strummer, people are scared to say it. Joe Strummer's early, like, 80s solo stuff is pretty bad. His 90s and 2000s stuff, like, Street Core is pretty good. But the ones before that, they're a little meandering. But, like, his – before Earthquake Weather, like, what was his band? Latino Rockabilly All-Stars and his other band that he had, too. Where's the magic, boys? Like, what happened? I don't know what happened.
Sometimes when you've been in a band that's successful, I mean, I'm not pretending to be inside their heads, but I do think sometimes you're just trying so hard to establish yourself as something separate from the band that you're known for and to try to prove that you can do something else. And, like, sometimes people just end up kind of, yeah, like, getting away from the thing that they're actually good at. Then I think in Joe Strummer's case, it took him a while to just kind of get back to that, you know, to, like, just get back to what he was – not that he was making music that sounded the same as the Clash, but to tap back into, like, the kind of songwriting that he was great at.
Well said. But listen, here was a victory, people. I have been going insane at record collections the past, I don't know, 6 months or so. And I've been getting high on my own supply, which is dangerous, except for it's been working out for me, which is even more dangerous. You know what I mean? I'm the dealer that's been getting high on his own supply, but I'm not getting busted. And people are like, I'll give you double what you want for that. You know, I'm like, oh, man. So I have a real problem. See, I'm in the worst part of addiction right now. Actually, I shouldn't make fun of addiction. I'm in the worst part of record collecting right now because – I'm making poor choices, but it's working out for me. That's a very bad place to be in. So I've been going to way too many record conventions, and here's why. I went to it wasn't even a record convention. It was a get-together at a brewery where they invented record stores to come sell records. And there was a store there that I've been to a few times. I like them. It's nice. It's very much a dad record store, like Beatles records and, you know, stuff like Little Feet, you know, that kind of stuff. And the dude had Kraut's first record for $10. And I'm like, I think that record's worth a lot more than $10. So I just bought, I mean, because any record right now is essentially worth $10, except for, like, you know, Bing Crosby. So I got it. And it turns out Kraut is worth a lot more than $10. But not only that, is I've had the Kraut CD for a while, but I played the record. Kraut is friggin' awesome. People might not know who Kraut is. Kraut was Doug Holland's band before the Cro-Mags, but they kind of are somewhat important on their own in that they're between the first wave of New York punk and the first wave of New York hardcore. And it actually is kind of English sound. I mean, they're a New York band, but it's got kind of an English vibe. Kraut's first album, An Adjustment to Society, fantastic record. You can get it very cheaply on the Discography CD. And I'm like, I've had this CD for so long. Like, why didn't I enjoy that? And I played it. It's just because the mastering is bad. The CD's from, like, the late 80s, and it just doesn't sound that good. And that's – like, I honestly – like, production and mastering really can affect the record. And so, anyways, if you can get a physical copy of Kraut's first album, highly recommend it. Sam Barrett, anything cool lately?
Yeah, I guess a couple things. So – I've been MIA on the podcast because I've actually been traveling, which is, you know, I guess a thing that we all do now because things are kind of normal. I don't know. Whatever. So I did end up, so I was in LA and I did end up at a show because I found super cheap tickets on StubHub, and it was Joyce Manor's 10-year anniversary for their self-titled, which is something I think Punk News did celebrate when it came out. I heard a lot of buzz on the website about it, and I think that's how I got into it. But yeah, so they played self-titled. I was probably in the back crying. But they actually, like, I think, like, re-released the self-titled album with, like, a new, like, cover. It's, like, orange now, and the vinyl is, like, that No Idea Mix Recycle puke color, which I'm not about, but whatever, I'll take it. So we got one of those. While I was in L.A., I did go to Amoeba Records and met up with Tricky Ricky Frankel. So that was always fun, because, you know, I like to see Punk News people every now and then. And I grabbed a European copy of Robin's Honey, which I know probably doesn't fit in this podcast so much, but I don't give a crap. I like Robin. I like it all. So I bought that.
I mean, Robin's got a punk connection.
She does?
Yes. Robin recorded with Diplo, who was a punker before he was a dance guy.
Well, so I did watch an entire documentary thing on, I think it's like What Is Pop or something on Netflix. And like a lot of like the pop albums that like came out was really like, I think his name is Johnny Pop or whatever his name is. He's actually like a metalhead. So there's a lot of like metal people out in Sweden making pop records, which is like hilarious and great at the same time. Yeah, so there's that. Recently I was in Baltimore and doing my normal record perusing with my husband, and we managed to snag a test press of War and Women's Capture the Flag.
Nice.
It was just laying around, and we picked it up, and I actually got a really cool stained glass 7-inch thing for my window, so I'm actually happy about that too. But yeah, I found some things. It's been weird.
Apparently Robin has also recorded with Nene Cherry, of course, of the New Age Steppers.
Yes.
And Rip Rag and Panic. Fantastic. Two thumbs up for Robin.
I love Robin. I saw Robin at MSG when I was super pregnant. That's like how bad I wanted to see her. I dragged my pregnant belly up the escalators of MSG, and I had like the best. It was such a good show. I had the best time.
Was that the concert where everyone on the subway train was singing?
Yes, girl.
Oh my God. Yeah. I almost got tickets to that, but I then spent the money on punk things. And after I saw like that article come out that people were literally celebrating and singing Robin on the train platforms afterwards.
Yeah, like people poured down into the subway after the show. And someone started like a sing along, and it's, if you look it up, the footage is actually pretty amazing. It's just like hundreds of people on a train platform all singing Robin songs together. It's like really actually like a pretty beautiful New York moment. It's awesome.
Yeah, I like literally kicked myself for not going. I was like, what the heck? Why didn't I do this? It's okay. I'm saving up my money for Spice Girls anyways.
Oh my God, how awesome. That sounds very fun and very silly.
Yeah, if it ever happens, we'll see what happens.
So I've come out of my CBD haze. I opened my Bandcamp orders so that I could actually have a coherent conversation about what music I've bought. I haven't received it yet, but I did order the Amel and the Sniffers record. I'm now looking at my cart. I mean, at my order, and I'm like very upset to see that I ordered it just on black vinyl when I know there was a cooler option. I don't remember what headspace I was in when I made that decision, but that's on its way. And then I got some stuff that was only available digital, but actually I got a lot of stuff that was recommended on that article you guys did on Punk News, just editors recommending music. So I got the Doom Scroll record, which was only available digital. I got the Hearts Apart record from Italy. I got that. It was only digital. And then I, the band that I played last week, Drinking Boys and Girls Choir, from South Korea, I decided to go for the digital version of their album as well, because the only thing they were selling physical was like a signed CD. And I was like, I'm not having a signed CD like shipped to my house. I just don't listen to, I, you know, that's just going to get burned onto my computer and I'm going to be listening to it digitally anyway. So yeah, so I've got one record on its way to my house, and then just a lot of like a lot of really nice MP3s that I'm enjoying. I'm like loving having good new music to listen to.
They have, and more.
And that's my book report. Bye, Helen.
And more. Did you enjoy reading Hamlet this summer? And or what's some like summer reading things that everyone reads this summer? Like Handmaid's Tale, or like what's the Bridge of Terabithia? Bridge to Terabithia is a very sad story. It is about a little girl and a little boy that don't get along with their friends. So they become friends in their own magical world. And the end is incredibly tragic. That is my book report. You will be smart for life.
I love that you mentioned The Handmaid's Tale and Bridge to Terabithia in the same sentence. I'm quite positive those two books have never probably been brought up in the same conversation at the same time.
Both excellent books. Very, very sad. Like we talked about this briefly, and we're not going to get too Hallie Bully. Incredibly sad and scary books for elementary school and middle schoolers. Thumbs up or thumbs down? Should we have fourth graders confront the horror, the tragedy and horror of actual life so soon?
I feel like that was what was happening. Like, I feel like that was really like when I went in the 80s, when I was reading that level of thing. Like, I feel like everything was scary and horrible. I feel like since then people have tried to like make like reading for young people like a little bit more like, I wasn't into that stuff when I was younger. I wanted just like a good fantasy story. But even like the Madeline L'Engle stuff that I read when I was younger, I read it now and I'm like, this is really dark and twisted. I think, I don't know how much of the like really, really dark stuff I was like truly absorbing, or if I was just like paying attention to the Pegasus on the cover of the book or whatever. But like, yeah, I feel like when I was growing up, things for kids were just so much darker, and I'm probably like in some way internally scarred by it.
See, I disagree in that like Wrinkle in Time, it's like a bad acid trip. I've never been on a bad acid trip, but like it's dark and it's like warping through dimensions and stuff. And like this kid, like her dad leaves her and she doesn't know why, and she warps through the universe. It's like holy shit, man! It's like a Hawkwind album. Anyways, I approve of scarring the youth. I mean, like even what the hell is it called? Aslan. Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. That's even pretty dark. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like in books like what, 4 and 5, there's the insane monkey that like kills people and stuff.
Oh, I never made it to 4 and 5. I love that you did though.
Man, a lot of good literature, man. And more. You getting cool records lately? Or do you want to just talk about Wrinkle in Time?
Well, I haven't really been out anywhere, so it's just been like finding stuff around. But I have been reading lots, and there's this book and it's really, really good, and it's called The Butchering Art.
The Butchering Art?
Yes.
Okay.
So it's about Joseph Lister. So he was a physician in Victorian era London, and he's one of the reasons why we have like widespread use of antiseptics. Like Listerine wasn't invented by him, but it's named after him because there was this huge boom of like antiseptic stuff after it was like, oh, people are living. So that was it's such a good book. It was really cool. So yeah, I read that. I just finished the Blondie book, Face It.
Nice.
So that was good. Support your local library. They do wonders. And as for like CDs, I've been trying to clean out some stuff. So, I found, I think 3 asking Alexandria CDs, and I don't know what to do with them. And one of them came with a sticker for, like, their record label. So I don't know if I can sell them or what I can do. But then another cool thing was I found the remastered version of Paranoid by Black Sabbath. So it has a 24-page, like, booklet with it, and it's really cool. And I think it's the 2016 remaster, but it's really cool. So I was listening to that, and, you know, only good times there. Oh, and then my dad found a an old Iron Maiden live cassette. So we don't have anything really to play it in now, but trying to find, like, stuff to see what it sounds like, because it's pretty much new.
For Walkman online, $10, you can get one of those and blast that bad boy on out. You can even run that through a receiver. Listen, I'm going to play a song, and this is from a listener. This is from Bobby, who's written it a bunch of times. This is Bobby's new band. The band is called Best Loop. They're out of Chicago, and they feature former members of the Ramblin' Boys of Pleasure. And we're going to play their brand-new track called Casino West by Best Loop. And we'll be back with the news.
Walk through casino doors, I'm black, she's red again. The only one standing between another bad day's end. And if I step inside you, sharpen keys, or do you know at least this mode is the plan of attack? Painted faces, there is nothing that you lack. Born in Chicago, died in California now.
And we're back, and that was Best Loop. Now, let's hit the best news. Aim on the Sniffers. They've released their third and final pre-album release single. It's called Hurts. And it's got Amy Taylor singing, going crazy, dancing around in the video. And I know Hallie Bullitt is psyched for this record. Hallie Bullitt, were you psyched by this video?
Yeah. Yeah, I just like her. I think she's so funny. Actually, it's funny that we were talking about Robin before, because there's like big sections of this video where she's just kind of like dancing in a warehouse. And it reminded me of the Robin Call Your Girlfriend video, which like she's very famously just kind of like dancing, just like feeling things in this big room by herself. But this is like like call your girlfriend, but like possessed by the devil. It's like so crazy. I mean, I do. I really like this. The song was stuck in my head for a long time after I watched the video. So that's a good sign. Yeah, I like it. I'm like maybe a little bit ready for them to do something different with the videos. But I don't know. It's still so much better than most of the videos I watch. So I'm not really complaining. What did you guys think?
All of these videos are made so well. Mm-hmm. Even though it's like, I think we've said this before. This person needs aerobics video. Like, that's what we need to happen right now. Probably after coming out of the pandemic, that might be helpful. But yeah, like, you know, just the flailing around, the dancing, like, if I saw her in the pit, I would get out of her way.
Oh, hell yeah.
I would not even, like, try to defend myself. I'd just be like, okay, you command the pit, go.
All right, you other schmoes, what did you think of this
video? I absolutely loved the first two Amon, well, the first three EPs or singles. I thought the first album, I didn't like it at first, and then I kept listening, and I thought it was absolutely fantastic. As I said on the podcast, I didn't love the first two videos because I'm like, I'm waiting for the song to take off. When's the song going to take off? It starts at an energy A and kind of stays there. This video, I liked a lot more than the two songs before. I didn't dislike the song before. I was underwhelmed, and I'm like, well, where's the fire? This feels a little bit constrained. I will say this doesn't quite have the berserk energy of the first album, but it's kind of more post-punky in the way that they're economical, snappy, sparse riff with Amy kind of shouting over the top. And I guess unlike the other album, they don't totally lose control. They stay in control, but they have control of that intensity, which I guess is arguably interesting. The point being is I actually was, I don't know if really more enthused by this song. I like this song a good amount. And I'm thinking, well, maybe the album, maybe it's going to be a clicker and then I'll have to listen to it two or three times and then it'll click. But also, maybe all the songs have kind of a different vibe and maybe it is very much an album type album and that like the songs are different and they fit together and it's like a full experience, which I'm hoping it's going to be. So I'm excited to check it out. I'm not going to go rah, 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 this is the best thing ever yet. I'm excited. There's always the other drawback, which I'm hoping doesn't happen and I'm thinking won't happen, but might is. Time and time and time again, we've seen punk band puts out kick-ass punk record, get some hype, and then says, well, now we have to go college rock, or now we have to go post-punk. And I could name some bands if you guys wanted. It was kind of a bummer. It kind of killed the band's power. And that happened time and time again. And it never really seemed to work out for bands. I don't know why bands continually do that. That being said, I don't know that they're doing that here. And it is interesting that they're not – Amy and the Sniffers are in a tight spot in that if they did a clone of the first album again, it would be a bummer. It's like you already did that. So I'm hoping and expecting that this is going to be a unique evolution for them and something cool. So I'm excited to hear the album, and I'm going to go from there. That's what I'm saying. And more.
So my theory that the videos are connected is wrong.
Oh, I was going to ask you if you found like through line. I was going to ask you what you thought.
But I think they're thematically connected.
Yeah.
Because every time, like, you know, she'll be dancing and, like, moving around and very energetic. And in all the videos, there's one time where she just stops and just kind of, like, her face kind of falls and she's looking off camera or she's doing, like, you know, she's just kind of still. So in the first two videos, that's near the end or at the end. But in this one, where she is, like, dancing in front of the mirror, and then she just stops all of a sudden and just stares, like, in the mirror with, like, I guess just staring at herself. So it's like, is it all about identity? Because, like, some of the songs are like, you know, oh, I want you to love me and everything. Is she talking about somebody outside of herself, or is she talking about herself? Like, is this kind of like an identity crisis almost? Like, she gets that way when no one else is really around or no one else is really watching. And it's like, is that the weight of the character, or is it just I'm looking way too much into something and it's just part of the video? But the part where so that's my thread of connection still. But I really liked the song. I thought the video was kind of like, it was disjointed and kind of cool. Like when she punches the light, that was good. But I'm excited for this. I think it'll be a good album.
Even on black vinyl?
Even on black vinyl.
Even on boring old black vinyl? Is it going to be a great album? I think it is.
Should we talk about the commenters, or should we not even dignify them with a response?
I didn't look, so I don't know how bad the comments
are. We're not even getting into it. Screw them. All right, listen. Bad Waitress. Emore, tell us about Bad Waitresses.
Yes, okay. So Bad Waitress, they are a punk band out of Toronto, and we've talked about them before on the podcast, and I really like them. So they just released their album, and they also released a video for Manners, which was the last single from the album. So the video, they're dressed up like creepy dolls, and they're moving very robotically, kind of like marionettes almost, like they're being controlled. There's no strings or anything, but like that's the style of movement. And it works really well because in the song, there's a chant that just says, or that sit up straight good, and that's chanted over and over in the background of the song. And I think it only stops for like 30 seconds. So like they couldn't have made a better video for the song. They go together really well. All the Bad Waitress videos I felt have been very good and put together very well, and there's a lot of stuff to kind of notice. It's so good. The song is so good. The first time I heard it, I wasn't completely sure, and then I listened to it again, and it's like, okay, yeah, like it's really growing on me. And just the background where it's a sit up straight good thing, it makes me so angry. And I think that's what they're trying to do, but it's just like, no, I'm gonna slouch while I listen to this, you know. But do not sleep on Bad Waitress. They're great. What did you guys think of the song?
I thought the song was cool. I'm not into creepy dolls. There was too many creepy dolls in this, but I do get it. You know, it almost feels like they are making, like they're pointing out, you know, control. I guess the topic of control is very important right now, maybe. But yeah, I think I could listen to the song minus the video. I think the video really creeps me out.
Well, I'll go ahead, Hallie.
No, go ahead, John.
Well, I am into creepy doll videos, and I dug this video a lot, and I dug the song a lot. It sort of reminded me of the Coat Hangers have a couple of videos where they're not like creepy dolls, but they're like sort of influenced by the girl from The Ring or The Exorcist, and kind of walking around in a creepy manner and spitting out blood and stuff. And I thought this video was real cool. I thought the song actually, to me, had a very much Sabbath riff vibe. Yeah. And even the vocals are kind of Sabbath-ishy or, I don't know, just kind of a creepy, almost death. I mean, the band doesn't present themselves as a death rock band, but if you put them in white pancake makeup with black lipstick, it would be a death rock band, you know? And so I think this is very cool. I'm becoming a fan, and I dug this a lot. And like I said before, I like how the young people, especially the young women, are taking punk in a new direction. It's still very punk, but I haven't really seen this exact kind of thing before. It's freaky, it's weird, and they're not trying to really please anybody, I think, which is very cool. And I think really right now the young women, you know, 18 to 24, are the ones doing some of the most exciting punk rock today. Hallie Bullitt.
I know this band. I had meant to take the time to look it up because I know they've put out songs that I really liked. I don't know why these last couple ones that I've seen from them, I just like haven't been as into. But yeah, I don't. I appreciate the sentiment. I totally got the message that they were putting out there. It's just like I didn't need to like listen to the song again.
Well, here's a message that no one is getting, and I'm astounded by this. Dexys Midnight Runners, one of the greatest bands of all time. And if people don't know Dexys Midnight Runners, they've got the song Come On Eileen, which everyone knows, which is a fantastic song. Before Dexys were Dexys, they were a punk band called the Killjoys. They put out one 7-inch, which is called Johnny Won't Go to Heaven, which is fantastic. There's also a Rarities collection, which is pretty good. Not amazing, but pretty good. Then they put out their first album, Searching for the Young Soul Rebels. Amazing, amazing record. Then they put out the Big Whammy, To Rye, which is a phenomenal album issued in two versions. There's the USA version and the UK version. Basically the same album, but different track list. Third album, Don't Stand Me Down, considered in the UK a subtle masterpiece, considered by John Gentile to be kind of boring. But that being said, Dexys, the main guy is a guy called Kevin Rowland, and he's an amazing singer. After the third album, Dexys broke up. Kevin Rowland put out two solo records, and we're going to talk about those in a hot second. And then he reformed Dexys, but it's kind of frustrating because it's called Dexys, but it's really like Kevin Rowland does like – well, like he like covered like – Kevin Rowland's an amazing soul singer. I mean, an amazing singer. And the thing of Dexys is called Northern Soul or Northern Celtic Soul, where they take like the spirit of Sam Cooke and apply to kind of punky power pop 80s, not post-punk, but after-punk kind of music. And that's what Dexys is, and it's an amazing. Modern Dexys is really just like Kevin Rowland like actually covering Sam Cooke. And it's like, as amazing as Dexys is, Kevin Rowland covering Sam Cooke isn't going to be better than Sam Cooke, you know, so it's kind of and if you go see them live, they do like all the old songs, but they do them in like a merengue style and stuff, which is frustrating. Anyway, we're getting off topic, and we're not, and here's why it's frustrating. The original version of To Rye has been remastered twice, once in a single disc version and once in a double disc version. Both have different bonus tracks. Both sound incredible. You should get them, I'm telling you, people. But for some reason, Kevin Rowland is now remixing the album again, and it's called To Rye As It Could Have Sounded. It's out September 9, or it appears to be out September 9. I think that's just when pre-orders end, frankly. So it's weird because we've seen this trend a lot with the Bob Marley Estate and actually with King Crimson, like we just discussed this. They're remixing an album radically that doesn't need to be remixed. It's not like it sounded bad. The original version and the remastered version sound incredible. So there's no real point to remixing it except for to make it, quote, sound different. But just because you're making it sound different doesn't mean you're making it sound better. You're just making another version that's kind of pointless, you know. I can only imagine it's going to sound worse because the first one sounds incredible. I hope I'm proven wrong, but I don't think I'm going to be. But that being said, Dexys is also going on tour, so I'm glad he's doing stuff. But this just does seem like weird barrel scraping and even like – him trying to change his legacy, which he doesn't need to do because it's an incredible legacy. So, of course, I bought both the CD and the vinyl, despite the fact that I'm probably going to hate them both. At any rate, if you guys want to respond to that, I can. Or we can talk about Kevin Rowland himself, who is a total weird. Does anybody have any perspective on Dexys or this thing that – I mean, not a lot, but some bands are doing this. It's like, well, we're out of rarities. We've already put out all the compilations. We've already put out all the good sounding live recordings we have. Let's just remix something just to remix it. The other great example, which got a huge blowback, which I'm glad it did, is remember East Bay Ray wanted to remix Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables? And everyone was like, why? That sounds amazing. And then he put out his remix and it sounded horrible. Like, why? You know, any of you guys have any perspective on this? Or
no. I mean, I don't know enough about it. It does just seem like an attempt to like keep making money really off this one song, right? Which is a monster fucking pop song. This song is like, Come On Eileen is undeniably it is so catchy. Like, his voice is amazing, and you're right, John, it has like this like croony, it has like this crooner quality, right, over like just a pot, like a perfect pop song. But like it you know, the 80s was weird, right? Like weird things could be hits. Like the fact that it has all this like Celtic like fiddle in it. Like I feel like only in the 80s could like a pop song like that just it, you know this replaced Billie Jean as number one on the pop charts.
Good.
When it came out.
I like him around you for.
Isn't that crazy? But can you imagine? You're like a relatively obscure pop band from the UK, and your song replaces Michael Jackson's Billie Jean on the pop charts. Like they must have been shitting their overalls.
Yeah.
Okay. Also, can we talk about the overalls in that video? Like, I rewatched the video because I was like, oh, let me like. There's so many overalls in this video. Like, they create a world in which everyone wears overalls. Also, overalls normally come with belt loops. Nobody uses them except apparently the members of Dexy's Midnight Runners who are like, oh, let's use these belt loops and belt our overalls. It's like just so, but like the video, the song, it's like so odd and so perfect and kind of encapsulates to me like the magic of what was possible with 80s pop, which was that like there was a lot of weird stuff and a lot of strange one-hit wonders and things that have not aged well. And then just like the weirdness of the pop culture at that time just left room for something really sort of beautifully weird like this to just like rise to the top. And I'm totally behind it. That being said, John, I like I didn't have this album back in the day. I just liked that song because I was little. I don't think I was even like buying albums yet. I did try to listen to the full album today in the car and I couldn't get all the way through it. I don't know. I probably would have liked it if I'd gotten it back in the day. I don't know, something that seemed a little corny about it to me. Am I missing something? Well, obviously you think I'm missing something.
You're missing the magic of Dexy's Midnight Runners. I don't feel it's corny at all. I just think it's an amazing sounding record. It doesn't sound like any other real record. It does have that Celtic Celtic influence. I don't think Celtic music, well, actually, I guess Celtic music does kind of sound like that. It's got a Celtic influence. It's got the soul. It's an interesting collision. What I would recommend is checking out the first album, maybe if it's too much Celtic for you, Searching for the Young Soul Rebels, which is basically the same type of album without the Celtic influence. It's basically just punk and soul mixed together. I think the band is amazing, and I was a fan before I knew this. Jack Terrycloth, the World in Front of Friendship Society, huge Dexy's fan. Also, one member of Dexy's was briefly in the early version of World in Front of Friendship Society.
Oh, dude, is that true?
That's the fiddle player you see in the video for Come On Eileen was in the early in one of the very early versions of World Inferno for like a number of months, like 5 or 6 months.
That's so cool. Well, while we're talking about weird crossovers, I need to say that I love this video, the video for Come On Eileen. It is only my second favorite overalls video because my first favorite overalls video is Bananarama's Cruel Summer, which I started thinking about because I was watching this video and I was like, oh, let me watch my other favorite overalls video. And then I realized that there's a crossover between Bananarama and the Come On Eileen video because the girl that plays Eileen is the sister of one of the women in Bananarama.
What? Just
odd fact. Yes. Totally. They were like spread single-handedly started the overalls pop movement in the 80s. This one family, these two sisters, they did it.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's some good research, Hallie. Damn.
it was more just that I love Cruel Summer. It's like one of my favorite songs from that era. And so as soon as I started thinking about it, then I had to like look up the wiki. It had nothing to do with my research for this show. It was just like me wanting to read more about Bananarama. All right, ladies, what do we think about what are we thinking about this Dexy's reissue, and what are Kevin's motivations for wanting to remix this album?
There has been like an uptick in just reissuing things, which I do believe it's probably because maybe money. I do also see that they're announcing a UK tour in September 2022, which I'm like, it's only September 2021. So I guess we're going to get more of that 1 year ahead of time type of things. So I'm interested to see where they land on the UK, because, you know, a lot of tourists do go into the UK a lot, and I wonder what is happening in COVID land over there. Because I've just been watching flights to London drop this past week. So, I don't know. Maybe we're optimistic about 2022. I don't know.
there you have it. Not to drag this out, but while I'm talking, I want all three of you to Google Kevin Rowland's My Beauty. So I'm going to start talking while you three Google that. So there's an interesting thing about Kevin Rowland in that he's a very weird guy, like very weird. And he's one of these guys that's kind of like Brian Wilson or Daniel Johnston. Like he's got all these love songs. You're listening to them. It's like, oh, man, love is so beautiful or heartbreak is so brutal. I know what it's like to have heartbreak. But like he's one of these aliens that like doesn't really reportedly doesn't really like have relationship with people. And it's like very hard to deal with. And, like, it, like, doesn't even respond to things in, like, a normal manner. Like, he's a very weird guy, by all accounts. And just that, like, he doesn't deal with things. Like, if you're wondering, you say, hey, Steve, how you doing? Or, hey, Jill. Like, Kevin Rowland, like, is discomforted by something as simple as that or something like that, you know. And so Kevin Rowland has put out – if you look at his photo picture, he's wearing a skirt. He's wearing, like, a full-on school mom skirt. And there's this thing that, like – people he's put this out in the forefront before and people like have never commented on it just because I think they were like uncomfortable with it or they're like not sure what is going on. Did you guys Google Kevin Rowland My Beauty, which is his second solo album?
Yes.
So he's on the cover wearing women's lingerie type thing or women's boudoir type stuff. And so like that was quite the shocking cover when it came out. And in 19, like I, people forget like how different the world is now than even like 6 years ago. This is like in 1999, like men did not put on like women's lingerie on their album covers. Like even the New York Dolls, like were women's clothing, but not like lingerie, you know? And so like, it was like at the time, it was like a super freaky cover, but no one asked him about it. And on this new press photo, he's wearing like a skirt and it's like is Kevin Rowland, does he like wearing women's clothing? Is he making some kind of a statement? Like, is there a purpose to that? And is it even fair to ask? Like, he's worn women's clothing here and there throughout his career. No one's like ever asked him about it because I think they like just didn't want to get into it. So is it fair to ask now or should we just continue turning a blind eye? Or should we be like, yeah, he's wearing a skirt. Men can wear skirts now. And maybe that's the right answer. Like, I don't know what to do. But it seems like he's putting it out in the forefront. I don't know. I mean, I'm, you know, the point being is now men wear women's clothing and so forth all the time. And it's no big deal. Kevin Rowland's been doing it for 30 years, but no one's ever addressed it ever.
I think it's interesting that no one addressed it before because it was considered a big deal back then, I think. But, like, I don't know, like, what is there to address exactly? I mean, clearly he likes wearing women's clothing. It's just something about that is, like, an expression that is, I don't know. Like, what is there really to say about it?
Well,
what's he going to say? Like, yes, I like wearing women's clothing. Like, what exactly is he going to say about it?
And maybe it's not a valid one, like, Buzz Osborne wears a muumuu, a women's muumuu, and he does it just to be freaky, kind of like the Fugs, you know? Similarly, Dan Bert Nobikin of Chumbawamba wears, like, a short black miniskirt just to, like, be, like Fat Mike wears women's lingerie because he's been clear. He likes getting off in women's lingerie. Dan Bert wears a women's miniskirt just to, like, be like, a freaky hippie, just to, like, freak people out. Yeah. You know, the Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention wear women's clothing just to be freaky. So it wasn't like, I'm identifying as a woman. We're just trying to freak people out. New York Dolls, you know, they didn't identify as women. Or even as cross, well, actually, New York Dolls did identify as cross-dressers in the public persona. But like Frank Zappa, when they wore women's clothing, they weren't, we like wearing women's clothing, wore women's clothing just to be weird hippies, weird angry hippies. Mm-hmm. You know? So like, what's the vibe that he's giving off here? Are we allowed to ask him? Or are you not allowed to ask that question? You know what I mean? My guess is that he's not trying to be a weird, freaky hippie. I think he just likes wearing women's clothing because he's wearing a skirt. But it's just like a normal skirt, if you will, now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then –
Am I looking at the wrong thing? Because I'm not really seeing him in a women's skirt. I'm seeing him in like – sort of like – oh, yeah, he's got – pantyhose. Definitely, those are like stockings.
Those are thigh highs.
Stockings and a stockings and a and a and stockings and undies and I don't know what this other piece of clothing is that he has sort of like half on and half off.
Well, you can also Google the
12 druid's robe.
If you Google the 12 inch single concrete and clay, he's wearing what looks to be kind of like a long school mom type dress or something like that. But also though, the other thing though is maybe it's unfair not to ask, like Kevin Rowland, are you a sexual rights pioneer? And he'd be like, yes, I am, and no one ever asked me, and I never got credit. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know? Or can you not ask him just because he's so weird? Because he is a weird person. I mean, not in regards to how he dressed, just as a person, he's a weird guy. You know, like Daniel Johnson or like Brian Wilson or something. You know.
I mean, I do just love how just like in any iteration of him, you see he is just so totally unique and just totally himself. And like you watch, like, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. This guy is cool. He's just doing his own thing.
Apparently he's got an alias, Carlo. Sometimes he calls himself Carlo. I did not know that. Well, there you go. So I don't know who's on the cover of this album. Is that Carlo or Kevin? I couldn't tell you. Anyway, someone play a song. Dexy's rules. Kevin rules.
I could play something. Apparently there's a lot of hype with this next band. This band that I'm going to play. This band, Turnstiles, they're from, I think, Baltimore. They're a hardcore band. They just put out a new record called Glow On, and it literally has been blowing up my social media accounts. Everyone's saying it's so good. I actually started listening to it because everyone else was saying it was so good, and it is damn good. Apparently all of their records are sold out and no one could find any. I don't know. But anyways, the song is called Holiday.
We'll be right back.
that was Turnstile, the band that everybody loves.
John's favorite Turnstile.
My favorite. Well, listen, here's two bands that are also causing a lot of buzz. Bob Villain, who in the UK is the current like hype guy right now. Bob Villain's got a new video for the song Pretty Things. I think he's only been releasing singles. His last one, which was a big hit, was called We Live Here, which sampled and featured him in a Crash t-shirt. Meanwhile, War on Women are back after maybe a little bit of time away. They released a video called In Your Path. And let's see here. That is a one-off. Oh, it's off Wonderful Hell. That was released in 2020. The video is quite direct, I would say. Sam Barrett, you got a Worn Women 12-inch test press. You have a perspective on Bob or Worn Women?
Bob is really cool. I have not heard of him before right now. And I'm really digging how funky and just, you know, crunchy guitars work together. I also do love the video and how, like, in the middle of the video, he stops and just says, "Who the F are you?" I really dig that piece of it. So War on Women. Yes, I did just get a test press, which was really nice. And happy find. This video is, like you said, extremely direct. But I think that just goes to, like, the band. The band is extremely direct in everything they do, right? I do like the fact that they took a Chilean protest chant and, like, I guess turned it into a song. Because I don't think that I would have known anything about the protest that was happening over there if it wasn't, you know, because of the song. Yeah,
these are like both super powerful, right? The thing I thought when I was watching both these videos is like the world just, and I think, you know, I've said this before, but like the world just needs punk right now. Like there's just so many things to be angry about, you know, and like, you know, shit is so effed up and people are mad and they have angry things to say against the establishment and, you know, systemic oppression. And like, that's why punk exists in the first place. It's like exists because people needed a way to express that stuff. So I don't know. I'm just like, I am excited to see people doing stuff that's so raw and so real and expressing like real anger and sort of the way Bob Villain talks about it in this song. It's like he talks about it, he doesn't want to write a pretty catchy song. He doesn't freaking feel like it right now. He's mad. And, you know, I there was something about that that really spoke to me. I mean, musically, I wasn't into this song as much as like We Live Here. I mean, come on. We Live Here is it's so powerful and also just like insanely hooky. But I don't know, this song and the video together, I just found it like super, super impactful. I felt like it was just this really, really honest. It was so honest, so like brutally honest, right? In a way that I was like, thank you for telling me, like, thank you for letting me understand how you're feeling as a person, as a black man, as a songwriter, you know, like just this, he specifically sang like, I don't want to write these other kinds of songs that y'all may want to hear right now. This is the song I want to write and that I want to sing right now. And I just that it really, I don't know. It hit me. Em, were you into this stuff? I mean, I guess they're pretty different. I sort of thought about them together just because they both had such a clear, like, political, you know, angle to both of them, and, you know, and just the real like anger that was being expressed. Em, what do you think?
I think that it's smart to group them together because they are both protest songs. The Bob Villain song and video, just again, awesome. Like, I love the aggression of it. Like, it's so nice to hear something like that, and just like no holds barred. Like, I'm gonna say this because it's on my mind, because this is what I'm experiencing, because this is what I'm feeling, and fuck you. Like, that's it. So it's really nice to hear that, and it's nice to hear you know, oh, we have to get along with people who are like Nazi sympathizers. It's like, you know, what is it? He, you know, he's like, I want, if I see a Nazi, I'm going to punch him in the face, like stuff like that. And that's good to hear because, you know, I'm not advocating violence, but like not dancing around a subject either.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is important. And one of the, I read an interview with the band, and one of the things they said was, if you choose a platform to stand on, then you better stand on it with 2 feet. And I think that's what they're doing and what they are going to continue to do. They released the We Live Here Deluxe Edition. So I listened to a bit of that today too, and it was really good. So I think they're definitely one of the most exciting bands in punk right now, just because like their energy and everything, and exactly, like, it's powerful, it's important, and it needs to be out there. With War on Women, I like the song and the video, and I like the directness of it, because again, it's not hiding behind anything. This is what's going on. This is what's happened in Chile. This is what the song chant was created by a Chilean feminist collective, Las Tesis. And it wasn't originally planned to be a protest song. It was just planned to be a performance art piece, but demonstrators during the protests took it up, and then it went worldwide. And people were singing it in all different languages and all over the world to protest sexual violence, which I think is really, really, again, powerful and like uniting. And it's nice to have something that so many people can get behind and that brings power to so many people and really doesn't pull any punches. And just one interesting thing in the video, Shauna Potter is wearing a blindfold and some of the other members are in blindfolds. And that is, that represents the mass eye injuries, including globe ruptures, that protesters suffered due to the Chilean riot police's use of rubber bullets that often contain a metal core, and tear gas grenades during the 2019-2020 Chilean protests. So over 1,000 people sustained damage, and I think 29 are permanently blinded in both eyes. Because of the police brutality. So I think it's good to get the message out there and get people aware.
John, what did you think?
I'm embarrassed to say how long it took me to realize that Bob Villain is a riff on Bob Dylan. No, I think Bob Dylan. You think Bob Dylan's cool, but I think Bob Dylan is cool too. I thought We Live Here was fantastic. I realized the point of this new song is I'm not going to write a pretty song. I realized the point is Penny Rambow said this with the Crass too. With Yes Sir I Will, we don't have time to write a pretty song for you. It's not time to be pretty. I get that, and I appreciate that artistic sentiment. And I like this song a lot. However, the fact of the matter is, for whatever reason, and maybe it's because humans are simple-minded, the songs and messages that seem to resonate the most with people are the ones that are listenable, catchy, and energetic. And so I'm not saying that Bob Dylan has to be, and I'm not saying that even he should. But there are a lot of artists that kind of make aggressive-sounding music, and they don't make – And I'm not even saying this is not even that hard. This is cool to listen to, but I think this would be Bob Dylan, from my perspective, would be a massive artist and also a massively influential artist if maybe he put a little bit more listenability, and I don't even necessarily mean nicer sounding, but a little bit more catchiness or easier to grasp onto. Like Saul Williams, phenomenal artist, but every year they're like, Saul Williams is going to break through. Saul Williams is going to break through. And he never really did, and it's because his music is very challenging to listen to. Why did Rage Against the Machine break through? Because Rally Around the Family with a pocket full of shells, bow, bow, bow. It's like super easy to snap into. And so I'm not saying it's artistically bad or poor to make music that is intentionally difficult to listen to, but I will say that for music to resonate throughout people, throughout, you know, history or whatever, it does tend to be the most the catchiest music and energetic that gets people fired up. And so I'm not saying that's what he should do, but I'm saying is I dig this. I would love it. I think it was a little bit more catchy, but that's my perspective. Maybe other people have different perspectives. So I think Bob Dylan is really cool. I think it would be a shame for him to be, he's going to break through. He's going to break through, but he never makes that, and I'll call it a concession of making more listenable music. And it can be a concession. I want my art to be raw and savage. But on the other hand, a lot of very famous artists, a lot of artists that really mean things to people, have said, well, it is important to make your music listenable because you want to make it accessible to as many people as possible. A revolutionary guy that made that point very directly, Boots Riley of The Who. Also, David Bowie. Also, Don Zientara of Inner Ear Studio. All people that have recorded or made music that has been very influential for people's mindsets have all – KRS-One, Chuck D, they've all kind of made that same statement, and they've all – broken through at least for a period of time. So I think he stands on that juncture. And I'm not saying it's wrong to be, you know, intentionally abrasive. And this track isn't even really that abrasive, but it could be hookier, if you will, to really resonate with people. And maybe he doesn't want to make that concession, and that's cool. And I don't fault him for that. But I think the fact of the matter, I mean, I don't even mean from a judgmental standpoint, I mean from a practical matter. If you really want to influence mass amounts of people, You kind of have to make catchy music, you know.
And you don't think, like, see, because I feel like what you're describing is that other thing, is We Live Here. Like, I feel like that was so catchy. And yet also, like, he didn't pull punches on, like, the sentiments he was expressing. Like, that, like, does that fall into the category of song that you're talking about? Or that one, even that one didn't speak to you, like, the music didn't speak to you either?
All right, I loved We Lived Here. It's difficult for me to say, and here's why. Because the youth, I mean, the youth are the people that catch on to these things and make these things explode. It's not 45 or 50-year-olds like, yeah, everyone should check out Rage Against the Machine. That's not how it works, you know? And the youth of today love mumble rap. And when I hear mumble rap, I hear gumbo, mumbo, jump. Like I want, when I'm listening to hip-hop, I want to hear someone like Megan Thee Stallion, someone like Cardi B. Boom, bap, boom, bap, chap, 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 chap. You know, I hate mumble rap. I hate it, you know. But the kids love it. So maybe my ear, even though my ear isn't attuned to this, maybe to the younger ear it is, you know. Although I honestly feel like it probably isn't, especially in the rock context.
Mm-hmm.
I think this track, I don't want to say suffers, but has the same characteristic of The Bronx. And I'm not a fan of with The Bronx, songs are 3 minutes long. Second 25 sounds exactly like minute 2:45. There's no growth in the song. And I feel that consistent sound is what keeps bands from going to the next level, but from really catching on wide. Maybe I'm wrong, you know.
No, I can see what you're saying musically. It was just like the lyrics did escalate in that way, in a way that, like, just the lyrics. I know what you're saying about the music, but, like, the lyrics did that for me. And so I was just completely drawn in by the end, you know?
Fair enough. Let's talk about one thing that has many people drawn in and repelled, and then we'll wrap up this episode. Cleopatra Records is back at it again, befuddling us as always. Of course, we've dogged on Cleopatra to a degree, and we've saluted Cleopatra. Cleopatra is a confounding label. They will put out, like, a super awesome record that, like, everyone loves, like, you know, like a Nick Turner record or a Tsunami Bomb record, and people are like, wow, Cleopatra. And then they'll put out, like, Steve Bader's long lost home demo from 1981 that he recorded in 7 minutes, you know, on deluxe colored vinyl for $35, and you get it, and it's like awesome. Cleopatra, they're a factory in that they, and I think they probably agree with this, they care more about quantity than quality. Another example is they just put out a soft cell record called Tainted Love, and it's like just weird remixed demos that, like, it's clear that they just bought these from, like, some guy that maybe had the rights to them. And so, like, Cleopatra is – it's hard to understand where they're trying to position themselves, I guess. And it's tough to give the label – Epitaph Records got a label identity, you know. Sub Pop's got a label identity. Matador's got a label identity, you know. ATO's got – like, I have no idea what Cleopatra's label identity is. And it's even more confounding now than it was 15 years ago. So to the mass surprise to everyone in the Danzigverse and everyone that cares even 1%, the reissuing Danzig's polarizing fifth record, of course, as the listeners, I'm sure they know, Danzig's 1 through 4 have the same four people on them: Glenn Danzig, Chuck Biscuits, John Christ, and Erie Vaughn. And they are considered phenomenal blues metal albums. All four are amazing. There are some people that think the fourth one isn't as good, but they're just wrong and they should go feel bad about that. But the first four Danzig albums are incredible. After Danzig 4 came out, Danzig fired his entire band and then put out Danzig 5, Black Acid Devil, which is a he's clearly trying to do Nine Inch Nails on the record. And a lot of Danzig fans, actually, at the time, pretty much every single Danzig fan hated it. Most Danzig fans consider it the worst Danzig record. And now in the Danzig Facebook group, where everyone has to say how much they're like, oh, it's an underappreciated classic. But you can tell they don't feel that way. You know, it's like, I will give Danzig props for trying something new. Maybe he was doing a little bit of trend chasing, which Danzig never needs to do because he's Danzig. But at least he tried something new, and at least he didn't try to get stale. There's a couple questions. Is A, should we reissue critically and fan maligned albums that maybe have some merit on vinyl? And also, why are we reissuing Danzig 1 through 4 or any of the Sandman records or any of the Misfits records, which if you go to any record store, people, any record store, there will be Sam Hain bootlegs out the wazoo. That is money Glenn is just letting fly out of his own hands. And instead of reissuing the Sam Hain stuff, he's reissuing Danzig 5, which I'm confounded by. And more. What's going on here? Did you buy the silver vinyl version of Danzig 5, Black Acid Devil, Danzig Does Industrial?
I bought 5, one for each day of the week. I have an interesting thing with this album, because this was the first non-Misfits Danzig album I ever listened to.
Whoa.
my friend lent it to me. And I listened, like, obsessively listened to it. I thought it was really good. And then I was surprised when I saw, like, people didn't like it. And then I went back and, like, I listened to, the like, 1 through 4. And I was like, ah, I see where they're coming from. But I don't think it's bad. I like some of the songs on it. And I thought it was kind of cool that Jerry Cantrell plays on See All You Were, Come to Silver, and Hand of Doom. So that was really cool. And yeah, I don't know how I feel about the Hand of Doom cover. That's, like, the only thing. Because when Black Sabbath does it, it's such, like, a visual song, and you can, like, feel it, and you can see everything. And then with this, like, it's still cool, but it just, I don't know. It loses something. But I don't know why they're reissuing it, unless it's just, you think you know what I'm going to put out? Surprise, here we go. You know, kind of like a left turn.
I know why Cleopatra's reissuing it.
Which is?
Let's make money. I don't even blame them for that. I'll give my opinion later if you guys want. But, I mean, if you want to know why Cleopatra's putting, like, you know, Matador's putting something out because they want to make money, but also because they believe in it. You know, Epitaph, they want to make money on it, and they believe in it, or they feel it's something the kids would really like, so therefore it's important. Cleopatra, can we sell 500 copies? Yes. Can we sell 13 variants to the same 400 people? Yes. Press them up, boys. You know, that's Cleopatra, you know. Though, to their credit, at least they're using the better cover as opposed to the horrible original cover.
I don't have anything to say about this. But I enjoy listening to you guys talk about it. And I totally relate to that thing of like the album that you just listen to over and over again that you just like is really beloved to you. And then you find out that other people, it was just like generally panned by the populace. And you're like, oh, wait, oh, like what was I hearing that no one else here heard, you know?
I still have some songs on my phone from it. So
that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Like, I just think that everyone's just reissuing things because they want money. And they will get it because I'm sure there's tons of people that will buy it. Yeah, like, I don't know. I did take a listen to the album because, you know, I don't really listen to Danzig or any of that. And I would have to say it is very different than I would think. I almost hoped that some of these songs ended up in some kind of like weird, like movie, like from the 90s, like, you know, maybe space things were happening. I don't know. Like it was very industrial for me. Yeah, I do think that the color combination of the silver with the cover does look nice though. And I like the 8 volts. So I don't know.
Well, here's the definitive answer. Anything that Danzig fans want and is authorized and approved by Danzig, if they're willing to pay for it, and if it gets Danzig money, I'm all for it. I'm also all for it because even though it's probably the worst Danzig record, it's interesting. It's not a bad record. It's interesting. It's got some missteps, but I'll give Danzig credit. He tried. He didn't do the same thing over and over and over. He tried to evolve. Sometimes he hit like Death Red Sabbath and Black Laden Crown, and sometimes they didn't hit as hard. So I think it's cool that he's canonizing this as a vinyl, which has never been out on vinyl before. I just wish he would kind of reissue Sam Hain and Misfits and Danzig 1-4. I think that's the most important tactic. But listen, if Danzig's getting paid and he's cool with it and it's kind of a nicer version of a record I already have, I say go for it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Now, listen, we've got two people to play songs. Hallie hasn't played a song yet. And Emma hasn't played a song yet. So who's going to go first?
It's been a long episode. I don't have to play a song.
All right. Emma, send us on out with Sam Barrett. Any last words before we send him on out with a tune?
Be safe. Don't be racist. Thanks.
Hallie Bullitt, any other words?
Very briefly, that the band Massive Attack put out this really cool, they did a study and they partnered with this environmental organization and they put out this big, statement about the music industry and its need to embrace environmentalism and the music industry's need to reduce its carbon footprint, especially when it comes to touring and all kinds of stuff. It's just super interesting. So if you're, if you're into music and you're into the environment, look this up. It's really cool thoughts that they've put out there about possible change that musicians and labels and mostly big production companies that put on concerts and festivals, you know, could implement. It's cool.
Massive Attack, one of those gigantic bands that a lot of people don't know about, even though they're absolutely gigantic, which is always kind of a weird dynamic. Robert Del Naja, cool guy, FYI. And more. Send us on out with a tune. And you can always read the podcast at punknews.org.
So one quick thing. If you're in Canada, make sure you register to vote because Election Day is in a couple of weeks. So I'm going to play. We talked about Bad Waitress on the podcast. I've been listening to their album No Taste regularly over the past couple of days. So this is Strawberry Milkshake by Bad Waitress. And I'll try and get it in.
Light pink wet dream, God fearing super queen, blonde team and fresh meat, service on the floor. Myers Cabaceti.